have a Bible with you this morning, turn to the book of Proverbs, right in the middle of your Bible. If you don't have one with you, feel free to use one of the Bibles we have there in the banisters halfway down the aisle. A lot of the Proverbs we'll be looking at will be up on the screens as well, so hopefully you won't need to turn to all of them, but maybe you want to look at some of them. Paul David Tripp, in his book, The War of Words, paints the picture of a story that probably every married person in here can relate to. He says, imagine a husband at work getting the idea during the day to surprise his wife that night with a date night. He's thinking about how much he loves her and how much time he wants to spend with her. And he's excited to go and have that alone time with her. And so he plans where they're going to go and what they're going to do. And he is excited all day to tell her to come home with the surprise. And he comes home, bursts through the door and says, honey, get on a nice dress, you get ready, I'll make reservations, we're going out tonight for a date night. And she says, do you have any idea what my day has been like? Ever said that, ladies? Do you have any idea what it's been like around here? I've been trying to, you know, mediate the opponents of World War III. It's been crazy. The last thing in the world I want to do is to go get in the shower and go get ready and have to put on a dress and, you know, go in traffic and go to a restaurant. You know, maybe you should grab the kids and go out and give me a night at home in the bathtub. And you can imagine, he spells this out in a lot more detail than I'm doing here, but you can imagine that the story from here extrapolates into a war, right? You can see where this is going, where he says, are you kidding? Do you know how many wives would just, they'd kill for someone to come home and say, let's go on a date because I love you so much. And you say, get out of the house. And she says, yes, you love me, but you're loving me in a way that only you want to love me in, and only a way that you want to communicate, not what I need right now. You're not thinking of me. You're only thinking of yourself and your own expressions of love, not the way you should express love to me. And they just miss each other. How did that happen? How many times have you had a knockdown, drag-out fight with a friend, with a family member, maybe with a spouse, maybe with a roommate, and you get done and you say, how did that happen? I mean, if we just went and watched the instant replay, I think we'd both be maybe amazed at how this thing just broke down and broke down fast. Well, today we're going to look at words and the power of words in Proverbs. Proverbs deals with the topic of words more than any other topic except for wisdom itself. Which wisdom, I would say, is not a topic in Proverbs. It is Proverbs. It's the umbrella of Proverbs. And then underneath the wisdom that's talked about in Proverbs are all these ways that wisdom is fleshed out. One of those is words. And words is the thing talked about more than any other in the book of Proverbs. So I'd like to break this down, a study of Proverbs on words, really just an overview of Proverbs on words for this week, and then next week specifically on conflict and peacemaking and taking correction and giving correction, all those wonderful things that we like to really spend a lot of time growing in and thinking about. Unfortunately, no, we don't work on them so well, do we? But we'll try to next week. This week, I want to break this down under seven headings. The first is the power of words. The power of words, both for good and for evil. For either good or for evil. For bad, for harm. A key proverb here is Proverbs 18:21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And those who love it will eat its fruit. Those who love what the tongue can do and are respectful of the power that it has will live by the fruit of it, but they also may die by the sword of it. Proverbs 12:18 uses that picture of a sword. Someone who speaks rashly is like thrusting a sword. When you speak rashly and harshly, it's a sword. It's powerful. The saying is, sticks and stones may break our bones, but names will never hurt us. That's not true. And your kids know it's not true, right? That's why someone had to make up that stupid rhyme, because a lot of kids were coming home crying because words hurt them, right? Words do hurt. Proverbs 15:4. A soothing tongue is a tree of life, but perversion in it, in the tongue, crushes the spirit. The same thing, the same word, the same spirit, the same tongue can go out in a direction that either brings life or brings a crush. It can either bring a sword or it can bring healing. We are hurt by words. As far as I'm concerned, throw a rock at me, punch me. But when I hear that you told someone that you think I'm a fake, that hurts. When you hear someone said, he doesn't really care about people, that hurts. And words have a power to affect reality, not fully and completely, but calling me an idiot may not be accurate, but it can make me feel like an idiot. They do have a power. Words have a power to really affect things. And we should take that in consideration as we use our words. We need to govern our words much more than we do because they're so powerful. And yet, the answer isn't to give up on words because they're powerful for good, right? And there's really no undoing the power of words. We can try to make amends for our words. When our words do harm, we can try to fix it. We can try to patch it. But it's something like drywall compound on a hole in your drywall, right? That it's maybe not visible to some people, but you know it's there, right? Maybe you can actually see the imperfections of that patchwork in the drywall. You know it's not as strong as the board itself as it comes from the factory. There's a patch there, and it might look all right from the outside, but it's just a patch. And words are something like that, where they go out like a sword, and putting the sword after it's been cut, after it cuts something, putting the sword back in its sheath doesn't make wounds go away. You can bandage them up, but scars often remain. There's no undo button on our verbal words. I love the undo button of Microsoft Word, right? You make a mistake, somehow everything disappeared. And that would have been bad with a typewriter, although you can't make everything disappear with a typewriter. But, you know, you had to get out the whiteout. I forgot what it's called. Is it whiteout? Whiteout. You use whiteout to block out the mistake. And now with, you know, Microsoft Word or other programs like that, the undo button is glorious. I keep looking for the undo button of life. I'm so used to doing undo up there in Microsoft Word that I keep thinking there's an undo button with woodworking. Ooh, there's not. It's get a new piece of wood, right? I wish there was an undo button with my words. And there isn't. The power of words for good or for bad. Secondly, think about the inadequacy of words. The inadequacy of words. Words are powerful, but it's also important for us to think about how limited they are. Words are really nothing more than the attempt of getting one person's thought bubble. You know, in cartoons, the thought bubble, words seem to have an arrow in cartoons, I've noticed. The words up above have an arrow down that are actually spoken words, but there are these little circles if it's a thought. Have you noticed that? Okay, thought bubble, picture that. What is communication? The communication goal is to get thought bubbles to be the same, for you to get what I'm thinking. I'm trying to do that right now, and the channel through which I'm doing that is a word. The words being spent out in order for you to get what I'm thinking, what I've been thinking about all week about Proverbs and words. So this is an issue very close to home for me. It is tough for preachers, or really anyone who does public speaking, to try and choose and order your words in such a way that they cannot possibly mean that, but they must mean this. And it is humbling and frustrating when you think you've communicated well in a sermon, in a message, and then someone repeats back to you what they heard you say. You go, that wasn't it at all. That wasn't it at all. You missed the point. You missed the point of the passage. You missed the point of the message. And my pride shows its ugly head by assuming they're bad listeners. They didn't get all the cues, the nuances of the words I was using. Well, it could be also that I'm a poor communicator. It could also be this is an opportunity for me to see my own pride as I'm aggravated that either my words didn't come out right, and I think they should, or And exposing of my pride is, I think someone didn't get what I accurately communicated. And this isn't just a problem for preachers. It isn't just preachers who feel that their communication falls short. How often do you feel like you just can't find the perfect word? How often, maybe you're getting older. I hear people say this a lot, and it seems to be even at 33 that you start to not think quite as clearly as you used to. And you can't think of that word that you want to. I know there's a word out there like that that means this, but what is it? And you embarrass yourself, and maybe it gets worse as you get older, maybe it doesn't. But none of us are finding the perfect word all the time. Our best wordsmiths in culture, poets, writers, essayists, they're constantly striving to find an adequate expression for a feeling, for a reality, for truth. How often do you feel misunderstood by a friend or a coworker or a spouse? How often do you feel yourself saying, either out loud, hearing yourself say out loud, or feeling yourself say inside, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. You're taking what I said and you're twisting it. That's not what I meant. You say it over and over, don't you? You say it so many times in any given year. And this alone should give us much caution with any kind of communication we do. This should give us much patience in our communication, because there's a good chance that this just began with a simple miscommunication, like that story that Paul Tripp gave us that I used at the beginning. The husband wanting to take his wife on a date. It seems like if you were either the man or the woman, you could get exactly why they were saying just what they were saying. And if you were in their shoes, you would be maybe using the exact same words to express your heart and your feeling. And you get it. It's just when we're in the middle of our own conflicts, we can't seem to be able to put ourselves in others' shoes so well. We can't seem to get ourselves out of our own shoes. And again, that's an expression of pride, isn't it? It's an expression of self-defense. It's an expression of me first. Proverbs even goes so far as to tell us that words are inadequate, such that they can't be trusted. Proverbs 26 says, some nice words are just deception for someone who hates you, and one day that hatred will be exposed, and their nice words will be shown just to be just a shroud, just an empty covering. Proverbs also talks about the fool who can look smart if he just keeps silent. He can look smart. The one who always has a furrowed brow, never talks, and you think he's rounding off infinity in his big fuzzy brain, and he's not. He's just a simpleton. He looks smart. Words can be deceptive. Now, that doesn't mean give up on words, of course. It means that words are not ultimate. They are simultaneously powerful and inadequate. And what we're doing so far in the message, just so you can, so I can share my thought bubble with you, we're trying to show just what an uphill battle this is before we even get into what Proverbs says we should do, what our words should be. Let's just admit up front, this is hard and we're not good at it. Words are powerful, and sometimes that's good. We love when powerful words are effective for good, for the Lord. He uses our words and blesses them. But more often than not, it seems like our words are powerful for bad, and they cut and they hurt and we regret it. And then at other times, they feel so inadequate. We feel so inadequate with our vocabulary. We feel like we're just bad communicators. We feel like we wish we could have our wives plug into our brains and just say, forget the words, just know my heart and my mind, because I can't really tell you, okay? I didn't mean what I said. You asked me if you looked heavy in that dress. I said, better than usual. And I thought that was good. It was dumb, I know. Okay, so we're getting at that issue of this is hard, this is uphill. So let's thirdly dial it in with the problem with words. Just how bad are we with words? Some of us tend to talk too much. We know that that's our tendency. Some of us tend to talk way too little. Maybe some of us are so afraid of the power of words that we just think we'll just not talk. And that's not an option. How many missed opportunities for good words go throughout our day? Missed compliments, missed praise, missed prayer. Don't forget to put prayer and worship, praise to the Lord, and prayer and praise about Him to others. You know, where we exalt Him in front of others, almost as a means of either encouragement to Christians or evangelism for non-Christians. How many missed opportunities for good words do we have in a day? We're made for this. We're made to talk to Him. We're made to encourage others. We're made for fellowship with others. We're made to encourage others about Him specifically. We're His mouthpiece for His exaltation and glory. And there's just so much. We go about our day just like mimes. Just mimes. Empty, foolish mimes. How much of our speech in any given day would we want to go back and edit if it was a transcript that was public for anyone and everyone to read? How much gossip that we say isn't gossip when at least it's shared with certain people? But if the person we were talking about was in on it, we'd immediately wish we could cancel that order. We'd immediately wish we could nix this from the record. Words are powerful and they're permanent, and we don't want them to be permanent and powerful like they are when they're used for bad. They're inadequate in other ways and they're so easily misunderstood. So let's face it, there's a big problem, and perhaps the biggest problem with the tongue is that it seems to be untamable. It seems to be almost be uncontrollable, like it's its own unruly master, like it's its own thing. James 3 puts it like this. It's so such wonderful, powerful imagery in James chapter 3. I'll read verses 3 through 8, and we'll have little snippets of these verses up on the screens for you. James 3 says, "Now if we put bits into the horse's mouth so that they'll obey us, we direct their entire body as well." Just a little bit in the mouth, and you can control the whole horse. "Look at the ships. They're also great, and they're driven by strong winds, and they're still directed by a very small rudder, whatever the inclination of the pilot desires. Small thing, steering a huge ship. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts great things. It does great things. It accomplishes great things for better or for worse. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire? Just a spark can mean a forest fire. The tongue is a fire." He goes on to say, "The tongue is set among our members is that which defiles the entire body." The tongue is the thing that gets our whole bodies in trouble. It sets on fire the course of our whole life. "For every species of beasts and birds and reptiles and creatures of the sea, we can tame them. You can find them in the zoo. They are tamed. It's tamed by the human race, but no one can tame the tongue. No one can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison." You know, we talked some weeks ago about the power of a gun. That when you pick up a gun, like money, money is powerful. When you pick up a gun, we know to have some fear and trembling with what it can do. And no one thinks, I don't think, I haven't encountered anyone who thinks every gun anywhere is always bad. So if guns are sometimes good, as long as the good guys have them, if guns are good, then it's an issue of what you do with it. But it's powerful either way. Either powerful to defeat a bad nation, powerful to protect a family, or powerful to do a drive-by to kill someone, to shoot someone in your home, to murder them. The tongue is like that. It's so small, and yet we use it so freely, don't we? Like money, like holding a gun, there should be some more fear, more caution, more carefulness in just speaking in general, knowing that it has tremendous power for good or for bad. So the fourth thing here is, why bother with words then? Why bother with words? Why should we bother then? You might be thinking, mime for Jesus? That sounds like a pretty good ministry, right? Just, you know, I'm in a box. I'm in a sin box, and that's it. I'm not going to talk. Is there a way maybe to go about relationship with my husband, my wife? And really, we just try to keep the words to a bare minimum because we've learned from experience, and you're saying the Bible teaches us, Ryan, words get us in trouble. Words are powerful, and they usually set a fire. Well, we can't give up on words. Proverbs won't let us. It does say to limit our words. It's an instinct that should be taken somewhat seriously because Proverbs does tell us that we should limit our words and be careful not to speak too fast. But we can't give up on words. And let me give you a few reasons why we can't give up on words, just in case you're tempted. Just in case. None of us are really utterly tempted. But you might just be so aggravated with communication right now that you're tempted to either just give up with communication or give up on trying to do better because you say, why bother? Why bother? It's just going to be a mess anyway. And you said, James says, the tongue is uncontrollable in some ways. Why can we not give up on communication? Because we're made in God's image and our God is a talking God. Our God is a talking God. He spoke things into existence even when there was no one there to hear it but He Himself. He speaks to us. He communicates to us in words. He's revealed Himself to us in words, in this book. He revealed Himself most clearly in His Son, whom was called the Word. The Word. He's the Word in the flesh, according to John 1. He is the communication of God in the flesh. When God says that Jesus is the Word, He's not saying Jesus is the Word and we know words are bad. He's saying words are powerful. And the essence of who I am has been communicated in a person, but not just a person in His actions, in words. He is the Word. He's the Word of God of the Old Testament, now in flesh before your eyes. God has made us for relationship, for relating to each other. He's made us for communication. Now, the fall has affected our tongues in a very significant way. In a very significant way. If you don't think that sin is in this world, well, friend, just tell me that there aren't people in this world who have made you so mad with their words, who have harmed you with their words. Just look at words, if nothing else. Forget, you know, Stalin and Hitler and Pol Pot. Forget those men and their murders. Just look at your own words and the words of others that have hurt. So why do we need words? The last reason to consider is that maybe nothing better shows us our need for grace. Nothing better shows us our need for grace than our need for words from others, our need for communication, and the problem of getting it wrong time and time again. The fifth thing to consider is the control of words. The control of words. And here, flip your notes over if you're looking at the sermon notes page. On the back of the sermon notes page, we have several categories, proverbial categories for what words should and should not be. So we're going to go through these categories here and at least give you one proverb from each of them. There are so many categories. This isn't even all the categories Proverbs would talk about with words. And of course, in each of these categories, we could go to a dozen or two dozen proverbial examples. We can't do that for time's sake, but let me tell you about a great resource that I've been using as I've been studying Proverbs. It's a little book called Proverbs for Parenting. It's edited by Barbara Decker. We don't have it at the resource area back there, but you can get it online. You can probably order it at a local Christian bookstore or something. What it is it's Proverbs broken down by topics. So it's not just for parents. I'm not positive this is a great title for it because it's not just for parents and in their parenting. This is for anyone who wants to study Proverbs on a topic. So you look up lying, and there is every verse in Proverbs listed for you, written out, not just the reference, but written out on lying in Proverbs. And so some of the same Proverbs are used in different categories because there's overlap. A great resource to have, a great resource to continue your study of Proverbs through after we finish this series. So get that. But let me give you some categories and a couple examples in each of these categories.
Proverbs tells us to keep ourselves from quick speech. Keep yourself from quick speech. Proverbs 13:3. The one who guards his mouth preserves his life. The one who opens his mouth wide comes to ruin. You can come to ruin from speaking too quickly. Proverbs 15:28 says that the righteous ponder in their heart how to answer. They ponder first before they talk. Not always, not in every single way. Not if I don't have it scripted, I'm not going to say it. But they're practicing on how to communicate. And they're cautious of certain times and certain ways in which they know their quickness of speech will get them in trouble. So Proverbs 29:20 says, "Do you see a man who speaks in haste? There is more hope for a fool than for him." He's worse than the fool. The fool in Proverbs is its own category. And if you're really going to understand what that verse says, he who speaks in haste is worse than a fool. There's more hope for him than a fool. You almost have to go back and reread everything it says about the fool so you can find out just how bad it is to speak in haste. Keep yourself also from too many words. So related to quick speech is too many words. Proverbs 10:19. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. Or Proverbs 15:2, the mouth of a fool gushes. The mouth of a fool just gushes. Be careful. More words equal more opportunity for sin. It doesn't mean we can't talk. It doesn't mean we should just govern what we say so that we say so very little. No, Proverbs won't let us do that. We'll look next week about those. We'll look at those Proverbs that say, he who conceals a matter, that's trouble. He who speaks too quickly, that's trouble. He who holds it in, that's trouble. He who gushes about that, that's trouble. It's both and, right? You gush, that's trouble. You hold it in, that's trouble. Different times, different ways. You have to apply the proverbial wisdom to any situation to know whether to answer a fool according to his folly or to not answer a fool according to his folly. But a biblical proverbial principle is guard yourself from too many words. Parents, can I encourage you to shepherd your children in this? Especially teenage girls that talk on the phone a lot. I mean, that's not really a funny thing, is it? That should be an encouragement to you. Oh, maybe we should just tell them talk less, because too many words does mean more opportunity for sin. It's like the chances get higher. More words equal more risk. It's like the Vegas odds are against you more, exponentially more, the more words you're using, the more you're talking. Keep yourself from too many words. In fact, Proverbs 20, verse 19 even says, avoid one who talks too much. Because why? What are you doing as you're hearing them? Well, you're talking too much too. If it's a real conversation with someone who talks too much, you join them in talking too much. Keep yourself from perverse and corrupt communication, it says. Proverbs 4:24. Put away perversity from your mouth. Keep corrupt talk far from your lips. We may wonder what that means in our context, because Proverbs doesn't give us the list of what corrupt talk is or what perverse talk is. And so it takes wisdom to flesh that out. But it is a biblical category. Like it says in Ephesians chapter 4, that there's certain things that shouldn't be named among us. There's certain kinds of coarse jesting that we shouldn't do. It's not fitting for Christians. Our language should not be exactly the same as the world. Keep yourself from gossip and from quick accusations, it says. Proverbs 26:20. For lack of wood, the fire goes out. And where there's no whisperer, the whisper in Proverbs is a gossip, contention quiets down. Just like no wood in the fire means the fire is going to dissipate, there's something biblical and there's something wise about, well, let's just make sure we don't talk about it, and maybe the intensity of the heat and the size of the flames will dissipate a little bit. And I know that to be true from experience. I'm sure you do too. Keep yourself from lying. In fact, this one's so serious. Proverbs 6 gives us one of those, there are six things the Lord hates, yea, seven are an abomination to him. Seven things the Lord hates, seven things are an abomination to him. Two of them are lying. Think about that. Two of them are lying. How is that? It's redundancy, right? Yeah. Repetition for a point. It says, seven things the Lord hates, a lying tongue. A little bit later on, after it lists three more, it says, a false witness who pours out lies. That's the same thing. Yeah, that's how much the Lord hates it. It made the top seven twice. Keep yourself from quarrels. Proverbs 17:14. Listen to this. This is so good. The beginning of strife is like letting out of water. It's like a dam where you just gave it a little hammer tap and now there's a leak. A quarrel, the beginning of that quarrel seems like, oh, it's just a leak. It's just a leak. But what happens now? The quarrel will break out. It will gush. It will flow. It will kill. Abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. Now, some quarrels you can't control. This is why Romans 13 is worth memorizing this little phrase. If you remember nothing else from Romans 13, keep this phrase ever in your mind. As much as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. There's some things that you can't do to make it right. Proverbs talks about that. We'll look at it next week. There are some things you can't fix. Some people who are mad at you just will not be reconciled with you. But as much as it depends on you, be at peace. As much as it's within your power to pursue peace, do it. More on that next week. It also says, keep yourself from enticement. Words can be used to tempt to sin, not unlike Satan himself in the garden. Could there be a worse way to use words than to entice people to sin? And before you think, yeah, that's for high schoolers, that's for junior hires, that's called peer pressure. No, there are other ways in which we do that as adults here in America. Think about it. You take that as a homework assignment, perhaps, and think how we do tempt others to sin sometimes. But it tells us also not just what's wrong about certain words and the way we use them, but how we can give ourselves to a right use of good words. It tells us to give ourselves to the wisdom and really the art of appropriate timing in a right manner of speech. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. Well-known verse, a well-known verse for you maybe, but one that we maybe don't apply nearly as much as we should. Soft answers turn away wrath. I can confront you, and we'll talk more about this next week, but I can confront you with a look and with a spirit and a demeanor where it's still not fun, but you at least know that I love you and I care about you and this is hard for me and I'm broken by it. That's way different than being quick to speak, being angry to speak, being loud to speak, not being gentle. That stirs up anger both in you and your listener. Give yourself to loving correction. We'll talk about that next week, so we'll move on from that one. It says also to give yourself to praise, to encourage others, to praise others. It tells us also to speak truth and to teach, to speak wisdom. Proverbs 10:21 says, the lips of the righteous nourish many. Nourish. Your words can nourish people, and it may be almost the only food they've had that day. The only kind of spiritual, emotional, relational food they had that day. You must speak truth at times and teach. Be quick to speak of who God is and what His promises are. Give yourself to self-control. Again, think about how bad we are on this. Think about how far off the mark we are on all of these. You know your own stories, your own examples of these failures, really. If we're honest, don't go through the list and say, hey, I remember when I told that person that and they hugged me for it and they loved me for it. Hear this first. Hear this first as law that comes to us, and it's not flexible. It's firm. It's God's law.
And it breaks us, and it's made to break us. It's made to make us somewhat helpless and hopeless so that we find our hope elsewhere. And really, it goes deeper than this. Think about the source of words. The sixth thing, the source of words. A New Testament principle is also found in Proverbs 16:23. The heart of the wise instructs his mouth. Now, this is very, very similar to what Jesus says in Luke 6:44. Maybe more well-known words. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Where do words come from? What's the source of the problem? I mean, will these problems really get addressed with duct tape? No, not really. Right? When words can't attack, eventually hands will. Right? If I put duct tape over your mouth, that's not going to help the situation at all. That's not peacemaking in the least, right? The heart of the wise instructs his mouth. You could say also the heart of the fool instructs his mouth as well. It's just out of his heart flows all kinds of evil things. And so out of his mouth come all kinds of evil things. Words are really not the problem. If we're doctors and we're doing soul surgery here, we're doing exploratory surgery here to open up and see what the problem is. The root of the problem is a problem of the heart. We've said that before in Proverbs. The heart of the problem is a problem of the heart. And words expose our deepest problem. Words are symptomatic of something far deeper than just tongues, than just mind thinking of words and facial expressions communicating feeling. Our pride is exposed through our own words. And our own words, as we boast, we express our own pride. We do it subtly. We do it in a way that's culturally acceptable. But we drop little hints about, yeah, did you know I did that? Yeah, did you know I got first? Praise the Lord. You know, quick, give credit. But really, what was it for? What was it? What did you tell them for? Is it an opportunity for praise, or is it, just wanted to tell you. I just wanted you to know. I just thought you should know. Oh, our pride is so often exposed in our own words, where we have the eyes to see it. Or our dislike for others as they talk to us, or as we express it in our own words. You know, those subtle biting comments that you can get away with. Maybe they're not confrontational worthy. They're not worth the other person confronting. But you know you can turn wit just a bit in a conversation. And it's not a sword, it's just a little dagger. Just a little poke. It's just a little fork even. You just get out a little fork of a word and you go, eh. And they go, ow. But then, oh, it's just a fork? Okay. And they go about it and you go about it and you're continuing with your fork vocabulary, poking people throughout your day. Just little jabs. Our need for acceptance is also part of this too. We can't miss the other side of the coin. We like people to talk nicely of us. We like people to accept us. We like people to approve us. We like people even to commend us. And so words are not just about us giving, us knowing when to be quiet. It's also about us hearing. It's also a reflection of our own heart where something in us wants. We want to be commended. We want to be approved, right? I mean, I think that's why so many of us maybe continue down a path even without God in the picture. Well, there's got to be some kind of reckoning in another world to come. I think that's why reincarnation got invented. What if there's no God really, per se, but there is still some payoff at the end, and you either get to be a cow or a dog or a cockroach, depending on how good or bad you were. What is that? That is people who are hopelessly connected to approval and how they did. And that's good, but it's been twisted. So the seventh thing here, the last thing, is that our hope hinges on someone else's words. Words. Notice up here on the screen, it's purposeful to say word, and then in parentheses is the S, because I mean that in a twofold sense. Our hope hinges on someone else's word, and our hope hinges on someone else's words. So let me go through both of those. Let me explain how our hope hinges on someone else's words. Jesus. He was pure in speech. He was wise. He was clever. He was humble. He knew when to speak and when not to speak. Read through the Gospels and see Jesus' right use of words. His right self-control. How he did confront and rebuke exactly when and how he should. And of course, he has the authority of the Son of God to do that. And he knows what's going on in people's minds, which we don't. So we can't make a direct connection to everything we should be and do in our speech as we look at Jesus. But where we can, we know this. That is how God sees us. That's how he sees our words. If we've put our hope in the righteousness of Jesus Christ as our salvation. Your words, all the missed opportunities for confrontation because you wimped out and you feared man instead of God. All the missed opportunities for praise and for prayer when you should have been praying, you should have been praising, you should have been publicly exulting in the grace and glory of your God in front of others, and you didn't. All those times when you didn't cut off someone with a sword with your word, but you poked with a fork. Or other times where you did maliciously swing a machete with your words and you knew you cut to the core. That got nailed to the tree. All those are gone. And the ones you're going to do tomorrow, those are gone. And replaced with that, through faith, is every good word from Jesus. In Psalm 24, it asks the question, basically, who can enter into God's presence? It says, who can ascend into the hill of the Lord? Who can enter into his holy place? And so you might read that in your morning devotions and say, enter into his holy place. Lord, I want to do that today. I want to be in your presence today. Who can do it, it asks in Psalm 24. The answer, he who has a pure tongue. He who has not defiled his tongue. He who has not lied. And so you might read that and think, okay, Lord, to enter into your presence, to be more in your presence today, I'm going to have to watch my tongue, to guard my tongue, to do what it said, which we read already in Psalm 141 earlier in the service, to put a guard over my lips. That's not the answer. Who is the one who had a pure tongue? Who is the one who, even at his death, was silent like a lamb before its slaughter, before its murder? Who has pure speech? There is only one. And Psalm 24 is a messianic psalm. It is clearly, we don't have the time to show it. We've done that before, and hopefully you know that. It's a great example of a messianic psalm that talks about Jesus. What's our hope for the presence of God? The one guy who has pure speech. The one guy who was innocent, he had pure hands, he had a pure heart, and there was no falsehood and no deceit in him whatsoever. He is the one that entered into God's presence and now leads the way for us to go into God's presence. That's what we mean by our hope hinges on someone else's words. Your hope does not hinge on your words. You will keep failing in those words until Jesus comes back. That doesn't mean give up. It just means your hope does not rest in your own words. It rests in the words of Jesus. But how does our hope hinge on someone else's word? Singular. There is a single word from God that is the ultimate word of approval. Justification. Justified. Justified or justification means God declares us righteous. He speaks us as a judge publicly to be righteous. He makes that edict. We are righteous, not on account of our own righteousness, but on account of Christ's righteousness alone. So he says, we are pure in speech and you can enter into my presence. You say, pure in speech? I wasn't pure in speech, Lord. When was I pure in speech? You weren't. My son was. He was pure in speech. And on that basis, through faith, we are declared to be righteous. Romans 3 talks about this, being justified, declared righteous as a gift. How do you get to be declared righteous as a gift? You're not righteous. If you really are innocent and the judge says you're innocent, and that's a gift, you say, that's not a gift, that's justice. But if he says, you are not innocent, any fool could see that from the evidence that's been piled up here today. But someone else has paid for your sins, your crimes. You're free. You are now, because of someone else, righteous. That doesn't exactly work in our court system, but it does work in God's court system. It did work. Jesus was it for us. It's like the man in Luke 18, the tax collector, remember, who just beat on his chest as he prayed and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. It says in the next verse, that man went home what? Say it louder. Justified. That man went home righteous. He wasn't righteous. He was a tax collector. The Pharisee down the row of the prayer line here was glad he wasn't like the tax collector. Thank God I'm not like that guy. That guy isn't looking down the row. He's just looking up and he says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And God says, I will be merciful. I will declare you righteous based on the righteousness of someone else. That's our hope. So this is the hope for our double need. Here's our double need. The first part of the need is we need acceptance, right? It's in us to want approval. It's in us to, I say to my wife, because she's not so good, she'd be the first to tell you, she's not so good about saying that she's mad. So like I can kind of tell she's mad. I've got a fish all day. It's like reeling in a marlin. You know, come on, I know something's wrong. Come on, I know something's wrong. And in her defense, she wants to make sure that love can't cover it. She wants to make sure that this is not something that is just silly and she shouldn't just let love cover it. So she'll give it time, but I can tell something's wrong. And so I'm reeling in the marlin and she eventually says, yes, something is wrong. Why am I so eager to find out if something's wrong? Because I love her and I don't like it when it's not right. I want things to be right. I want her to accept me. I want our relationship to be accepted by her and she by me. And that's how it is with God. We want to be accepted. It's within us to want acceptance. The problem is we look for it at all the wrong places and we get it all twisted and we think that the temporary human acceptance that we get might actually replace the acceptance with God that we really long for. And if we're accepted by Him, then really, ultimately, what other acceptance matters? You see, our hope for the double need is a need for acceptance, and it's also a fix for our pride and a fix for destructive speech. So a couple of very brief implications. One, in light of God's acceptance, we are now put aright to communicate with Him in prayer and in His Word. He now is restoring words. He's restoring souls. And the implication of Him restoring our soul is that He's restoring words. In the first place that should be expressed is in prayer to Him and in love for His communication to us. All of a sudden now, words are alive, even where prayer seems hard. Think about what it is. It's an exchange of words with the God of this universe. Give yourself to those words. It is a blood-bought gift for God to communicate as He has and to make a way for us to communicate to Him in prayer. Another implication is that this reality alone, this double hope, Jesus' words on our behalf in God's Word, approved, righteous, that alone can transform our hearts to speak to others with truth and joy and grace and humility. It is His forgiveness that gives us hope when our words seem to cut and we feel bad afterwards. We shouldn't just feel better when we can make it right and they accept us and we really think it has been swept under the rug and no harm has been done. That is not really the fix for our conscience. Our conscience really is fixed by by one thing. Whether that person accepts your repentance or not, make sure things are right with God. Make sure that that forgiveness with Him alone gives you hope, even when your words seem to have made just a mess. And in His forgiveness toward us, we are freed now to forgive others when they use their misspeech, when they use their bad words against us, when they gossip against us. We think, who am I that I should not be maligned when Jesus was maligned? Who am I who've been forgiven so much to not forgive them? Now, it is the gospel alone that can actually transform that fiery tongue that seems untamable. It seems unruly. It seems like it's its own beast. And you're sick of it getting you in trouble, aren't you? What can transform it? Willpower? A communication class? Being a mime? No. Thank God, none of us have to be mimes. The only hope is Jesus alone. His grace frees us to forgive others from their misuse of words against us, and it enables us now, motivates us now, to use our words as He's made us to use them, because He's restored in us a heart that wants to love and not hate.